This is The Lonely Office, your playbook for navigating the messy line between work and life. Our topics are sourced from real, anonymous workplace conversations happening within Glassdoor communities. From going through 10 rounds of Zoom interviews to the scam that is unlimited PTO, we discuss timely work-life issues so you don't have to brave the professional world alone.
So here's a scene. Lee is a young, bold creative. He's actually an aspiring filmmaker. And he's at this industry networking party, you know the kind, right? One of the female guests comes up to him and asks, "What do you do?" He responds, "I'm a film editor. In fact, I just finished editing my first short." He's very proud. The party guest interrupts him with a bizarre reaction. "Oh, I'm sorry."
What?
Lee is confused, but she goes on to console him. She says, "It's okay. AI is out to get all of us. My time will be coming soon." Lee is actually crushed by this. He was aware of AI advancements in the image space. It felt like new updates kept coming faster and faster. Were his kind destined to become ghosts of the industry? Was AI Pac-Man going to gobble them up one and all?
There we go.
Sorry for the dead joke. Deflated, Lee starts to question whether to pursue his dream any longer. Then he comes across an inspiring post in his social media feed where he learned about the 10,000 hour rule.
Malcolm Gladwell. Yeah.
He's the one that introduced it. 10,000 hours is the amount of practice time it takes to become a master at something. So instead of throwing in the towel, Lee doubles down on the fight. He pursues 10,000 hours learning advanced skills like visual effects, motion graphics, and CGI. He spends thousands of dollars that he puts on credit cards and hopes to pay in the future. Either way, Lee's all in. Get it, Lee.
Go get him.
Never give up. 6,000 hours into this odyssey, Lee is forwarded an email from one of the instructors in his class. The subject reads, "New AI motion graphics released." Lee actually ignores the email. Doesn't faze him. He reassures himself. It's still far behind. Static images is one thing. But AI can't create motion like humans can, right?
Famous last words.
Lee forges ahead with his training. And 3 months later, just as he is about to eclipse the 10,000 hours, his social media feed, again, is on fire with something called Sora.
Oh, yeah, of course.
That's amazing. Yes.
It's a generative AI model that produces motion and videos based on a simple prompt. As Lee watches these videos and he reads the press release, he slams his fists on the editing bay with anger. He knocks over his clunky Avid machine, big noises in the apartment complex. And Leia and Matt, it was rumored that his entire apartment complex could hear Lee screaming, "Damn it! Damn it all!"
Have either of you experienced that moment in the story, the networking party, where others mention AI? Like, are you certain you're going to have a job or not? Is that going to be the new thing?
Definitely heard that conversation or that line of questioning about working in advertising. But also, I have a relative who's whatever the kind of doctor it is where you're looking at slides. I've heard him asked, "Aren't you worried about AI? And are they even going to need that type of doctor in the future?" So I think a lot of us are getting that line of questioning.
We would never have thought it would hit the white collar professional, right?
My initial defense to any of those questions at events at first was like, "Hey, I'm a traditional storyteller. That's not going to touch me." And then when they come back with the, "Yeah, have you heard the AI voice modeling technology?"
Ooh,
then I shit my pants.
That's scary. Yeah. So on that note, Lee's story, I think, figures for some of us very similar or straight out of a science fiction horror film. But, you know, instead of Rise of the Machines, remember that Terminator movie? This new film genre is going to be all about the futile struggle of a white-collar professional racing against the advancements of AI. And the tagline is going to be, "We never saw them coming." Or didn't we? When the first consumer LLM application, that's large language model, dropped in the form of ChatGPT, we were told, we were forewarned that this Gen AI thing may move faster than previous technological waves, as it gobbled up more data and added more parameters. But I'm not sure we really grasped just how fast. Bloomberg published an article titled OpenAI courts Hollywood in meetings with film studios and directors. So Sora apparently is taking meetings with Scorsese and Spielberg.
Wow.
It's only 16 months since ChatGPT dropped. Is AGI really moving that fast? If you pay attention to technologists and when they talk, when they prognosticate about the future, you'll notice all their predictions always happen in either 5 or 10 year increments. It's short enough to feel relevant, but long enough not to be called out on their bullshit. Watching examples of Sora's work, it's clear that even in her raw, unreleased form, she does have some real magic. Her cinematography, the impossible physics of some of the camera angles she's capable of. Most of us, not even the tech folks, can claim to have seen this one coming so fast. But here we are, as we all gaze in collective wonder at what's transpiring, AI's impression on us, our confidence, our purpose, our calling, or simply our jobs, begins to reveal itself. So that's our topic. I think we wanted to really focus in on what's happening in real time in the creative industry. There's this sense that creatives may be the last line of defense in this thing. As AI makes its way across each white-collar profession, the collective America, we've always seen creative, and namely film, as kind of the holy grail of commercial art. If and when technology was going to get there, it would be the last line of defense. It would be the last form of human innovation or creation to be usurped. And so, yeah, what's your take?
Yeah.
What have you been noticing and seeing living within the agency world, the creative world?
My initial take was like, yeah, don't really have to worry that much, right? Because it's not that great yet.
You sound like Lee at the 6,000 hour mark.
That's the thing, right in line with what Lee found happening in this story. It's becoming more and more real. I think it's exciting for creatives, but also very scary. There are a lot of ways where it's making the creative job easier, but people are always eager to underpay creatives for their work. And so if there's an excuse like, hey, you can just plug this into Photoshop and generate a new image, then
it's like easy pickings. And yeah, there's a Glassdoor thread that kind of speaks to this. It comes from a senior art director. I want to know why AI evangelists are so keen on killing creatives' livelihoods. So you want to concentrate even more wealth to the very top. I love new tech, but at what cost is it to the future of creativity and making commercial art, design, photo careers for the very wealthy 1%. And then just reading off one of the comments here from a copywriter, there's a swath of people out there who on some level are jealous, envious, or regret that others have made a career out of creativity. Any chance they get to say, see, it's not that special. They take it and profess it under the guise of progress and democratization. So what he's observing, like these tools are valuable, but it feels like someone trying to guard the keys to the castle, like the last guard of the keys to the castle. And you know, once you take over that guard, the castle has been conquered.
You know what keeps coming to mind for me after hearing both of you is the sort of line in the sand analogy. Even with those folks we're talking about in the Glassdoor thread, they're not saying it, but the metaphor here I'm thinking about is just this line, right? What is that line of defense? And is it a line of ethics? Is it a line of creativity? Is it both? When you were setting us up, Matt, and you were talking about Scorsese taking some meetings with Sora, first thing I thought was this dude, not only a film enthusiast, but a traditionalist. He has a reverence for the artistry of film, right? He's talked about this. But then I was like, wait a second, didn't he just use some early forms of AI in the movie The Irishman?
That's right.
On Netflix,
yeah.
The 3-hour odyssey, where really the movie was only possible using Robert De Niro, Al Pacino, and Joe Pesci by having that sort of generation, or at least the technology to be able to make their face look aged. And so the film industry, CGI, they have been utilizing technology that's at least integrated or in the same paradigm,
right,
as AI, right? And now my only thought would be, you know, wouldn't it be great to be a fly on the wall in those meetings? I'd love to see if Martin Scorsese is basically saying there's a line right here, right, that you're not going to cross,
yeah,
or if he does see the benefit, if it's used properly, it's used in good faith, that it could actually help the art form. So we have two different roads here that are possible.
Because you mentioned like CGI and this thing being similar, the way it's different, the way this thing, generative AI, these large language models, Sora, is different than CGI is that it's democratizing access. It's the same way,
that's right,
YouTube democratized user-generated content, access to creating content on par with like reality TV, let's call it, in the early 2000s. And MTV and a number of networks got their lunch eaten. And so I think that's the difference here, is that it's being democratized. And so you no longer need these really expensive visual effects studios potentially to create all these graphics, yeah, on the premise of a few prompts, execute similar quality level that you'd get from a production house. That's the promise, at least.
I was just going to say, Aaron, from an advertising perspective, the line in the sand currently seems to be legal teams. For big companies, there are no model releases with AI. You don't have the paperwork. So they can't be certain that if you're running a social ad or you've created a TV spot with an AI-generated human in it, that someone's not going to come out of the woodworks a week later and say, hey, that's me. The AI scrubbed my image from the internet and now you're using me in an ad. So at least from what I'm hearing from friends, small brands have sort of dappled with using AI in social media posts and things like that. But the larger brands are still, the legal teams are going, no way, too risky.
So legal is actually the last line of defense.
Yeah.
that's what's going on. But that never fares well, right? I mean, what happened in the music wars? How did that play out ultimately, right?
Yeah.
A lot of people are not familiar with YouTube. YouTube grew on the back of pirated or illegal IP, namely Seinfeld episodes being uploaded in. And the rumor is actually that the founders of YouTube were just like uploading episodes of Seinfeld as fast as they can, or third-party conduits of theirs, and it blew up. And by the time the takedown notices started coming and they would take them down, more would come back up. And that's how YouTube actually got started, on the back of content, not get theft. So law didn't work too well in that case.
Well, it's clear there's a transformation. You're right. The origin story, I think, like, origin stories don't always start off necessarily illegal, but they can be transformed into something good. The rumors in my family was that my great-grandfather came over from Sicily illegally and had this very traditional sort of Italian-American immigrant experience, jumping off the boat in the harbor and all that kind of stuff. My whole point is, somehow along that line, it did transition. So I hear about your story. I think about, okay, maybe it started off that way, but man, what a power then YouTube created for the democratization and access to video content creation, to brand building for individual content creators in Montana or Ohio or wherever, right? That's actually a really cool thing. But again, where's the line? So maybe specifically when we talk about film, I won't turn this into a Turner Classic Movie diatribe. When you're talking about that, well, like, what jobs are at stake there? Are we talking about, okay, cinematographers? If you're creating images with a single prompt, right? And we're looking in the world of film as the holy grail, you're basically taking away camera operators, grips, folks on the set. I mean, you're taking essentially live capture, and there's a whole swath of creatives that get knocked out of the process. So it doesn't like kill all the creative space in the movie making collaboration, but it looks like there's a huge portion of that that can go by the wayside while some remain. And I feel like that actually might be where the warfare is.
Yeah, there's a clear theme here in a lot of the posts we're reading, of a bit of frustration with the technologists. And I think this goes back to a long, bitter rivalry of sorts and back and forth between creatives and technologists that goes back decades. But that same feeling that was evoked with the previous post about this is being purposefully done to take away some of the creative talents and abilities that we have, or to usurp what we have. There's a lot of this finger pointing happening between creatives and technologists. And so here again, why are we allowing AI to do the work that humans should be doing? Why aren't these resources going towards redundant, physically intensive, or mind-numbing work? I just can't understand how OpenAI, pointing towards Sora here, wants the best for people with this new tech and then does shit like this. So again, that's like this lack point of trust of like, what's really the end game here? And is this the best way to deploy this technology?
Leah, I think it was an episode or two ago, you had talked about in the advertising space.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
The role of traffic, which was carrying around the actual creative from department to department and getting everyone to check off and approve it, but physically carrying it around.
This was a paid role. So in agencies,
yeah,
they employed—
it was called traffic.
Traffic, and this person would go and take the creative for signature sign-off.
Mm.
And for a while, because I worked on a digital account, we had a project manager and traffic.
Right.
And they had different roles. And then at some point they were like, do we need traffic? I think you're seeing something similar with AI being used to create mockups for creative or storyboards. There are people in agencies who source Getty imagery. The creatives will say, we want to mock up a storyboard that shows a kid playing with a dog and then going to the pool and then going to school. And like getting those images and mocking it up so you have the same kid doing all of these things. Now AI can create a storyboard with exactly what the creatives want. And you maybe get an animator, or maybe you would use, again, stock video, but to create a fake version of the ad to put into testing. Now AI can create that.
Do you think there's like a new bucket that's acceptable in the advertising world, where whether it's a mock-up or a PowerPoint or even some visual aspects for an ad, are we basically saying that, like, okay, this isn't art? I'm saying there could be a perception from an industry standard that's like, this is commercial. Yeah, we can use it for this. But then to your whole point, your opening, Matt, then there's the line of the Holy Grail. I think what's happening here when you mentioned Sora and what Lee's dealing with is that Sora is sort of like breaking through the boundary of art for like an ad campaign to a revered form of visual expression. It's crushed that boundary. And that question that was brought up by that user, okay, if you have the best interest, when you release this, you knowingly, you're destroying that boundary.
Yeah, I think your point, the comments as well, make it clear that there's this sensation that AI is coming for film now. And if you think about the launch, the early days of social media and what they call Web 2.0, like basically when YouTube launched and a lot of these video platforms. At the time, the incumbents were the networks, right? The NBCs of the world, MTVs. And even then, if you look at the type of content that was being spawned, it was user-generated content. It was everyday folks uploading videos and reenactments that maybe at that time was on par with reality TV. And at that point in time, a lot of the executives were like, oh, this content isn't quality enough. It's not going to be able to replace what we do with our reality production, you know, our camera crew and lighting and all that. And you fast forward, it took only maybe 8 to 10 years. So YouTube has a global user base, a global viewer base of 2.6 billion viewers now.
Wow.
One of the best kind of performing programs on network TV, Sunday Night Football, has 21 million viewers. So network TV got killed by technology, in this case, UGC, user-generated content. And now it's like it's coming for film. A quick kind of personal story here, looking at the film industry too, because it's on the back end of the story that Bloomberg published about OpenAI in Hollywood. I have a filmmaker friend who works for a major film production company, and this film production company is all about the graphics, right? Like advanced visual effects, CGI, some really iconic animated movies that we're all familiar with. He works there. And I got in talking with him, and I was very shocked to hear what he was saying, that he took a look at Sora, even in its early raw form, and some of what it was doing, and he sees the writing on the wall. Now, granted, he's a bit more digitally savvy than other filmmakers, but the fact that someone in a tier one production house, which is all about visual effects and CGI, takes a look at this thing and it feels threatened, to me, that was really eye-opening. And so I think what we're painting here, within the creative world, there's film, and then there's, let's call it like the agency, the creative agency world that includes, could include network TV and commercials. And just kind of go back into the creative agency world here for a second, Leia. What have you seen or some of your creatives seen regarding, yeah, using this in like maybe ad formats? I know like I've used this tool to create digital ad versions for the studio that I run, which is like an app studio. And most of the ads we create, we all create on version of an AI, whether GPT or another version of it, the images.
Yeah, so I know media teams are using it for sort of mass production of copy for A/B testing.
Right.
The cynical side of me is like, well, you're running tests that are just removing all of the crappy copy that AI wrote. So why not just focus in on decently written banner copy or online right. ad copy? But anyway, and then I know I just mentioned obviously sort of mock-ups, so pre out in the world creative. The concern seems to be, let's say you're making an ad for Budweiser, you've got to certify that every single person in that ad is 21 and up, right? You can't do that if you're generating images with AI.
Why not?
Because they're not real people.
Right. But therefore, you don't need permission. You don't need consent.
I think the worry is that some 16-year-old's mom is like, that looks like my kid. And now you're in a legal black hole because no one knows how that will play out.
That's really interesting because I was coming across a story and apparently now AI influencers exist with hundreds of thousands of followers. And in one case, it was a creative agency in Spain created this AI influencer who, of course, based on what you just said, is derived from a composite of millions of pixels of other people. Every one of our pixels are embedded in this, you know, AI influencer. Should we all share in the revenue?
Well, and did you see this story? It was in the news not too long ago about this woman who had posted a TikTok, a really raw TikTok, and a company had taken like her clothes, her background of her apartment, totally different voice, and had her talking about an erectile dysfunction drugs. She was on her honeymoon emails, I'll send you the article, and texts.
This is unbelievable.
People saying, like, talking about this guy named Mike, who's not her husband that she was on her honeymoon with, But I mean, you wouldn't find a reputable company or a reputable agency doing something like that. Not in my experience. I know that everyone is very cynical and skeptical about that. In my experience, the companies I've worked with have been very careful.
I feel like it's the smaller agencies for sure that will be able to jump on this faster, because back to the legal line of defense is they have less to lose. And so in the particular AI influencer example, I believe it was a smaller agency in Spain that launched it. And
they'll probably win an award at Cannes.
See, I think what you've both talked about so far, I think it actually begs for the necessity of a line. I also was really happy to see the WGA strike and some of the other strikes that follow, because I thought at least it was an attempt to start to draw that line.
Yeah. So the way they resolved it is the WGA struck a deal with the Hollywood studios. And the portion of that deal that was AI specific was that AI could not be used at all to write or rewrite scripts. Meaning if you were a writer who created a script, usually it goes through an infinite amount of rewrites. Everyone's familiar with the industry. They can't use AI to do that under this agreement. They also can't use the writer's scripts to train AI either, or
that's right.
Use AI generated writing cannot serve as source material. So there's all these provisions around AI, which read to me as like, they're trying to create a fortress, which we know how that story plays out.
Do we?
Yeah, but is AI as a tool that dangerous? As a tool, not as the end all be all of creative. Like, I've got friends who have to do competitive audits for work, and now they use AI heavily to do that. But the strategy, the data is still their own.
When you say that, all I can think about is Captain Picard going through a difficult crisis and he's talking to the computer about doing the self-destruct mode on the USS Enterprise. He's going back and forth with the computer. Now, here's the thing. How does that story play?
Always the dated references.
Star Trek is infinite, but I would just say this. When Picard's on the Enterprise and he's interacting with that tool, the computer on the spaceship has parameters. They built those things in that you're talking about. There are those lines that are there that it can't do. But here's the beautiful thing of the story. How does it always play out? He's at the end of the story. He's interacting with the computer. There's a choice to be made. And at the end, 9 times out of 10, the computer suggests something and Picard has a human intuition. And 9 times out of 10, it's the human intuition that wins, because the rational framework for the decision lacks a human quality and the human quality wins. My whole point is I use it as a tool and I use it all the time for my consulting business, but there is a line I'm always going, I have to put my own spin on it.
There's a really interesting, we're going to get to this in a second, but there's a really interesting paper that was published recently by an MIT labor economist named David Autor, where he talks about AI, the way it's actually rebuild the middle class. Just a little tease, we're going to get there. But what he discusses in his paper is this idea that AI is different than computer automation that came before it, in that it's a composite of tacit knowledge. That historically speaking, computers and networks and information systems could compile all this information, but it could not replicate the tacit knowledge that humans would be able to do. But now the tacit knowledge is replicated in the form of the pattern recognition that it's doing. The reason I bring that up is because in that comment we just read, where the creative is saying, well, you know, why not focus on mind-numbing work? The story of Lee is the story of the white-collar professional being threatened. Is this elitist of us, or elitist of the professional knowledge work in this case, where there has been decades of blue-collar jobs that have gone obsolete because of automation in the factories? You know, there's oil and gas industry workers are going to lose their jobs as solar takes off. We don't wink an eye in that case, because there's some benefits in some cases to the climate, but also because we see this as mind-numbing work. Now, all of a sudden, when the AI threatens the knowledge workers, the ones with all this tacit knowledge, we think twice. Hey, really quick, if you've enjoyed and benefited from listening to The Lonely Office,
they love please, the show. They don't just enjoy it. They Aaron, love it, Matt. I'm sorry. Sorry, dude. Sorry.
Okay, I got to finish this up. Please leave us a 5-star rating and review. It really helps us make more episodes.
I think it's a great argument to be made. You could also say the individual or the middle class, so to speak, the blue collar person who maybe is plumbing because they can support their family, or maybe they're doing a job they never wanted to do because of someone got ill. They have that dream to write a novel. Well, now ChatGPT-4 can ethically work with them to get that first draft out of the way, all that mind-numbing work, so they can focus on the individual creativity of what makes the book different, which is their voice. If it's your voice and you're just building on your voice, that's different. If it's inspired as its own voice and you're passing it off as yours, that's when we have a problem here.
Wasn't that tool, Aaron, you were mentioning that you can replicate your voice as an AI clone?
Yeah. Eleven Lab is one of the, I don't mean to call them out.
How does it work and why did you choose not to do it?
Well, it's one of those things where you actually just like record your voice into the third party platform and they mirror and try to, and they get pretty close. They have samples of Obama and different other well-known Americans and global thought leaders. And the danger there, as you could see, is like what can happen from a legal standpoint, from impersonation, from exploitation, all that stuff. And for me, I just felt like, damn, like I drew my line. I saw the utility of it. I'm like, oh shit, I could produce like 50 blogs a day, audio blogs that I could put on my website and generate more traffic. But it's like, I don't know. It just doesn't feel right. Because that's the mirroring of my voice and my calling card, my purpose.
Your purpose. Let me read another post here. And this gets down to the anxiety. In this post, there's a cry for help from another creative. Please help me do something with my fear of artificial intelligence. Very literal here. I have felt great anxiety because of how quickly it's developing. And I'm afraid when it becomes capable of replicating the human writing, what people do will lose its value and purpose itself. And this leads me to doubt, what's my purpose going to be? Am I going to be useless? And so in that example, Aaron, it seems like you were hesitant because you started wondering, well, geez, I mean, what's Aaron good for in that case?
Yeah, I mean, and maybe, and the other real fear is, what if AI Aaron is more efficient and better than human Aaron? Because AI Aaron doesn't get tired, doesn't need food, doesn't get cranky, doesn't get sick. But ultimately, isn't those failings the unsanitized human nature of it that gives it character?
The three of us put our voice out into the world every week. They could.
Right. What if they clone us?
I'm telling you, they could do it without your consent.
To be fair, I think of the three of us, I'm probably the easiest to clone. My purpose on this show is just to occasionally serve up some facts. So here's another fact. Talk about cloning. And this is a little outside of the creative sphere, but I thought it was a really interesting story. Just to play towards this anxiety point a bit that exists in other industries too, right? We're focusing on creatives, but there are other industries that are being impacted. So just a few weeks ago, there was a Swedish tech company most of us were not familiar with called Klarna. Its US counterparts would be like PayPal or a company called Affirm. It's all about this buy now, pay later solution. Anyways, they released this press release announcing that its AI-powered customer service chatbot was doing the work of 700 full-time staff and that as a result, it was going to immediately freeze hiring in its customer service division. Almost on cue, right after that release, one of the biggest publicly traded business process outsourcing companies, these are the companies that house these humans, you know, call management centers and all this stuff.
Yeah.
Their stock price plunged 29% in one day. Customer service and some of the scripted way that tends to play out, that's almost like even a more obvious use case. So like clearly we're not implying here that creatives or the creative industry is the only at play. I think the interest in this episode was that in many ways creatives are the last line of defense. We've always thought our creativity and human ingenuity would save us if there ever was a robotic apocalypse.
Do people not notice? Surely people have been irritated with the chatbots. I know I myself have been irritated with chatbots. I don't know. I haven't used Klarna, so maybe they're just much better, their chatbots, than the ones that I've interacted with, which are always stupid and annoying.
Agreed.
You know what's funny? It's gotten to the point where I was once frustrated with a flight change I couldn't make. I jumped on the chat service.
Yeah.
And I felt that the thing on the other line, you don't know anymore, is it a person chatbot, was being very unresponsive or unaccommodating because I'm a loyal customer with a lot of whatever miles. And so at some point, I'm like, can I speak to a human, please? And they're like, you're speaking to a human. I'm like, no, like, I don't want to speak to the AI. I want to speak to a human. And the person was insisting. They're like, no, I'm actually a human. Like, we've reached this warped world.
That's awkward.
It's awkward.
Of course, we're talking about line for creatives. But man, from a business standpoint, I work with a lot of companies that specialize in customer service. Wouldn't an AI customer service that's programmed to be optimistic and kind be amazing? Not angry at you on the phone or putting you on hold for 20 minutes?
Yeah, there's the flip side.
There's a flip side. But one thing, that theme that keeps coming up here, or at least came up coming full circle of the story, there was a line where it was like, Lee is crushed. Like right away, Lee's confidence.
Yeah.
And we talked about, you know, myself and writers and Martin Scorsese. I mean, you think Martin Scorsese having a confidence crisis just looking at his beloved art of film? I wonder with all the excitement, if there's also kind of a confidence killing vibe with professionals.
So on that note, there was a poll. I believe this was a Glassdoor poll for Employee Confidence Index that was circulated in the media. Employees were asked the question, are you positive on your employer's 6-month outlook? And it turns out since the creation date of this index back in 2016, this was the lowest rating on record. I think this latest reading came out just last month. Only 48% of employees said they were confident or felt confident. This was down from highs of 56% in 2022. And going as back as far as 2016, it's still 2 to 3 percentage points lower. So what's interesting is like the stock market is booming, right? Unemployment rates are at relative lows, decade lows. Real wage growth has been stronger than it has been historically. Yet we are very unconfident. We're very not confident right now. And when I read this poll or this index, I almost immediately felt the AI has something to do with this.
That there was an attribution there to some degree?
Yeah, I mean, this is not statistical, it's my own reading. But like, sure. You look at ChatGPT came out, the first LLM came out in the end of 2021, November 2021. And it's been a slowly dipping downwards, even though the market has been recovering.
I mean, the price of eggs were also skyrocketing at that time. So
that's right.
Could be part of it.
I mean, that's like more of a survey read of it. But yeah, how do you feel about personally and amongst your coworkers? Does it feel that way?
I think for creatives, it's a mixed bag. Depends on the creative that you know. I have filmmaker friends who text me who said it's over, right? Who've given me that sort of apocalyptic text. And then I have other creatives that reach out to me in different spaces where, like, actually, like Leah was saying, I'm going to use this as a tool and I can actually be more productive. I found for me, but it just gets out of the way the stuff that I don't have a ton of time for and costs me time. I wonder, maybe it's creatives that are safe because you still need the creative mind to send the prompts.
I agree. I think you still need the creative minds to send the prompts. I've worked with so many creatives who ideas are just outside of anything that I would have ever thought of.
Even if you were to prompt some of these language models, like, hey, I want an off-the-wall idea inspired by the likes of some comedian.
There's an AI company right now who will scrub a brand's social media and then look at like a photo shoot you've done and tell you this image is going to do well on your social feed. But then what are we doing? We're just appealing to your current audience. So if the brief from the client is, who should our new target be? And how will we bring those people into the fold? Like an AI predictive read of what you're currently doing isn't going to get you there. I don't think it can off the wall yet. And maybe it will be able to soon.
Sora and some of what's showing, it's like technical execution of some of the cinematography could be promising. But on that note, having used these ads, even Facebook does AI on your ad. And what it does is, to your point, is it optimizes elements in the ad in a way to like maximize the click-through rate. Mm-hmm. But what I found was it was doing nonsensical stuff, guising the value prop in a way where it's like you couldn't read the copy and it taking some face that was, you know, maybe the prettiest face in the ad. It's like zooming in on it. It was doing really weird stuff. I think it was producing more clicks, but not necessarily helping out from the brand side.
Yeah. So, but it's clickbaity.
I actually used AI recently to work on a sort of a one-off podcast script that's going to be used to raise money for a potential funding of a film. I inputted my idea of what I wanted the script and the episode to look like. I was very clear. I was like, I just want you to create a skeleton. And I had almost a 5 to 6 paragraph vocalized prompt. And then it spit out a very janky but skeletal product that resembled my original prompt. And then I just went prompt after prompt after prompt and tuned it and revised it just to be the skeletal structure, not to have the actual script itself, but the guiding posts. And so far it worked out, but it still required the creative mind to come in with the original concept. Now, I think the point here going all the way to Lee's story is, okay, Sora might be a marker. That is the line in the sand because yes, it's a prompt, but the act of the creation of the thing, it's a final form.
You're getting out of the realm of the first draft and you're entering into like, if not final form, but
that's right,
V3, V4 territory, and it kind of gets scarier. What's interesting about this is I think the emotional or the human part of the story we were interested in covering is like the confidence part, right? I'd imagine at the end of the story, even in a case where Lee calls upon that deeper force within him and continues the struggle competing against AI Pac-Man, he's lost his confidence. And
it's true.
I would argue even in a scenario where AI ends up being an enabler, that it doesn't replace us, you still lose your confidence because it's really a matter in my mind of like, how much purpose do you get out of execution when you're not responsible for executing it? The reason I'm bringing this up, I mentioned at the top, David Autor, right? So this MIT labor economist, he published a paper just recently. It's called Applying AI to Rebuild Middle-Class Jobs. And what's interesting is his take is actually that AI could significantly benefit the middle class by enabling middle-skilled workers, emphasis on middle-skilled, to perform tasks typically reserved for highly educated professionals like medical care, legal writing, and software development. And in that perspective, or in his perspective, he views AI as a tool to revitalize the middle class rather than replace them. So elevate the middle manager towards a decision maker and give them a bit of a superpower. And honestly, like in its current form, this is what I'm seeing, where I see both on the engineering side and frankly, even in the marketing, at least the performance marketing side, individuals who use this thing who maybe don't have as much experience or just hard skills or maybe even talent, raw talent, can kind of level up with this thing. But if you're at the top end of it, if you're a top end engineer or a top end creative, there's less of a delta improvement you get out of it, right? That's right. And so in that scenario, I kind of buy this argument of his of sorts that it's an equalizer for some of the middle skilled workers, as he puts it. And, you know, we can get into the examples if we want to, whether it's like a nurse practitioner or a physician assistant. My wife is a physician assistant. And by definition, that's someone who doesn't do 8 years of medical school, does like equivalent like three, right? Something like that. The truth is, leveraging AI, it really levels up her performance in understanding diagnoses, you know, and you talk to any NP or PA, they will tell you the same thing where they're not reliant on it. They're still doing their own reads, but the extra 4 years of med school or the extra 10 years of experience that a healthcare doc had, now the NP can replicate of sorts with this. Back to the scenario where even if it just is an enabler, I feel like it could be a confidence killer even in that, because you're just even more reliant on outsourcing decision-making to someone other than yourself.
We've talked a lot on this show, though, about people who aren't getting answers, aren't getting help from their managers and make mistakes, right? Could also be a confidence booster. I mean, you can ask AI to say, write a creative brief for you. And you could input a bunch of creative briefs that your manager or your agency have created before and use it as a way to be managed by someone who's not properly managing you or who's not properly training you, I guess I should say.
Do you think the manager would care in that case? Is that you or is that the AI?
I mean, I would probably care. Because I go so much on my past experience and my gut instinct after doing this so many times before. It would feel weird for me if someone was sort of faking it. Seems like cheating.
It's interesting. I recall very vividly the first time I could use, it was before Google, Yahoo, and Lycos search engines to search information for a research paper. Oh my goodness. I don't think certain generations like understand, like we'd have to go to the library and check out books and bibliographies and all this jazz, right? And so back then I considered it cheating of sorts because it was undefined territory. And so you kind of did it and then you kind of pieced together that same information from what book it is and you claimed that you actually read the book when you didn't. Fast forward now, this is not, you know, just reference material any longer. This is like writing the paper. This is creating the V3, if not the final form.
So as a counterpoint, the other day my son asked me for help with a math problem. And I was like, I'm just going to put it into AI.
That's all I do.
And
that's all I do for
AI
my love.
AI spit out an answer. And I was like, it says this. And my son was like, that's not right. Mm. I was like, what are you talking about? And he was right. It had used three instead of three-fifths.
It's bad with
and
math.
He was like, he literally typed on my laptop. He was like, change three to three-fifths. You got it wrong. And it was like, oh, thank you for letting me know. And then it recalculated and got the answer right. So you still...
It's getting there. It's getting there. It's like Lee's story, the motion graphics email update release, but the final...
Yeah.
You just hit something that's really important. It's almost like we pick and choose where we're okay with the cyborg attaching itself to us, right? I don't like writing. I'm not a great writer, but I'm a great writer in my brain. So I build confidence when a machine can just get me 40% there with all the shit I don't want to do. Then I can go in and go, oh, thanks for that, because it would have taken me 6 days to do that. I make a concession to say, you can replace that. Leia, you just talked about like helping with your kid's math problem. Same with me. I'm like, yeah, algebra, whatever. I'll concede to having a helper there. But then there's this line, right? It crosses into our sense of purpose and our own humanity, where it feels like it's too much of a concession. And I think Lee, the reason why he's flipped over that Avid machine and he's saying, damn it all. I think you're right, Matt. He lost confidence early on after that networking party. And I think he felt in that moment that it crossed that line and he lost a dream. He lost a part of himself. And I'm just hoping Lee ends up basically going rogue and creating his own economy where he goes and just does film on 16 millimeter, creates a cult audience, right? I think that's what's going to emerge. You're going to have sort of this human versus AI kind of art. And where are you going to stand as a consumer on that line, not just a creator? But what do you think about Lee's ending here? Any hope for him?
There's still hope for Lee. I really truly believe that there will always be a place for art created by artists in our world. I think people value it. Maybe not enough people value it. And I do think advertising can be art.
I agree.
I agree too, Leia. But my concern is more like there's a lot of art where if it can't be commercialized, you would never have, right? So how much of the film industry movies art in its own form, mm-hmm. Scarface or whatever the genre of the movie is you like, they make money, right? So if now all of a sudden the medium of presentation for human creative art is a galley in the back, right? Where it's like, there's nobody transacting there. It's just like, you know, occasional, you know, peephole, you're going in and looking.
Oh, jeez.
Just real quick though, Matt, I can't let you off the hook though. Leia gave her sort of hopeful ending. I gave mine. You didn't answer it. Like, what happens with Lee here? Seriously, after the breach of confidence and his career as a young creative.
So I think Lee's kind of an outlier because I think that was such a devastating emotional scenario. He actually might quit. Mm. I think the majority of Lees who find themselves as film editors in train, they will find the medium ground where they're like, okay, I'm going to partially cave. I'm going to use this tool to help me enable do some of the CGI or the visual effects work faster. And find that kind of even ground. But I don't know where the sense of purpose and meaning ends up for Lee. I honestly don't know. Like, it may be enough for him to continue having a job and pay the bills, but will be enough for him to be full of pride and passion, the same passion that he had when he first started in the industry. I don't know. And I think that's kind of the question of this all in this episode is like, can you retain the passion? Yeah, you sure you retain your job.
Let me offer one last line, which is, Lee's story could have the best ending ever if he picks up the Avid machine, doesn't stop, and his first break in the industry is editing the next Star Trek movie. Let's go, Lee!
If Sora doesn't keep to it.
Hey, you made it. Thanks for tuning in to The Lonely Office. If you like what you heard, follow us on all major podcast platforms so you don't miss an episode. And make sure and tap 5 stars and leave a review. I know everyone says it, but it actually helps others like you discover the show. Remember, the topics you hear us talk about on the show are sourced from Glassdoor communities, where professionals are having candid conversations about their careers anonymously with others in their industry. To be part of that conversation, download the Glassdoor app. And when you're in the app, make sure and join the Lonely Office Bowl. That's where we are. When you're there, you can suggest a topic idea or an episode idea, or you can make it more formal and email us at thelonelyoffice@glassdoor.com. We'll catch you next time.